Hello, and welcome to episode number 7 of Research VR Podcast, where we dig deeper inside the current insights of virtual reality and map it upon scientific research. For those of you joining us for the first time, Research VR is a weekly podcast dedicated to breaking down years of research in cognitive science for virtual reality into a digestible form and discussing the current economic trends of the industry around the world. In today's episode, we're discussing the question of, is there a glass ceiling in VR ecosystems, the European nations versus the US? Besides me, Azad Balabanian, we have our usual co-host, Peter Lekoff, and two wonderful guests, Sean Whitmore, who is a senior analyst at Greenlight VR, and Nima Ashgari, who is the founder of Caspian Robotics.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi, everyone.
So, Sean, welcome to Research VR. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Greenlight VR and what you guys do and what you do there specifically?
Yeah, absolutely. My name is Sean Whitmore. I'm a senior analyst with Greenlight VR. I've been with the company for about half as long as it's been around, so about a year and a half. It's total, so about 8 months or so. We do market and business intelligence for the VR industry and a little bit of the AR industry as well. Currently we have several reports out in the market, some unique and first of its kind consumer reports, mapping out content preferences and purchase intentions and fears and concerns across US and UK samples of over about 3,500 respondents. We're gearing up for our second industry report where we're going to be doing first of its kind and accurate, I'd say, projections for the industry going into 2025. And right now we are currently holding our 2016 Virtual Reality Analytics Web Summit that the whole team of Research VR here is going to be attending, and the listeners can attend with 30% off discount code Research VR. And the link is in the chat box, which you can also just go to greenlightvr.com and under events will be right there. Personally, I have been a lifelong gamer, and I have been obviously following the VR industry ever since Oculus got bought in 2012. And so getting into Greenlight VR was a pretty no-brainer with my research background from UCSC in psychology research, just kind of taking the research best practices that I learned there.
Shout out to Santa Cruz over here.
Yeah.
We have two people from Santa Cruz today. That's awesome.
Banana slugs. Just taking that like best practices research into the space that I actually knew quite a bit about. Then from there, I've just been mapping cross verticals with the gaming industry and seeing how the talent is spreading out all over. And it's been really exciting to be a part of it.
Amazing.
And Nima, who's joining us back from our last episode, you want to give a little introduction about yourself as well?
Sure. So I'm also a cognitive scientist like Azad and Peter, but last year I took a couple of months off university to found my startup in Berlin. We are working on fully autonomous drones for boring industrial inspection applications, but the science behind it has a lot in common with what you guys do in virtual reality and augmented reality, especially the use of computer vision. If the audience hasn't yet listened to the last podcast, there we already gave an intro to what are the common areas between VR and drones or robotics in general. And we talked about the whole space in general. So today, I'll be kind of the guy who is a European young founder and also somebody who comes from the drone market. And I'll try to give my viewpoint from that perspective. We'll talk more about the commonalities, but I think everybody here agrees that these two topics of drones and virtual reality, they're both from the frontier technologies. And there's a lot in common to be discussed.
Nice.
Very cool.
Okay, guys. Should I maybe give a short introduction on what a glass ceiling actually is?
Yeah,
sure. No, let's fill everybody in.
So for the one who's listening and don't know this term, a glass ceiling is a metaphor for an unacknowledged barrier for, when you want to advance to a profession or, you know, create your business. So because you can see the amazing opportunities above you, as you know, the ceiling is out of glass, but you can't really reach out to them because you can't go through glass. So the effort to break through is rather pitiful, while you all the time are, you know, mocked by the idea that there is something above you that you would really love to reach, but you just can't do. Hence, we together with Chris and Sean actually tried to understand the European and the US differences in terms of VR market. And Sean was doing some crazy analysis. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about your observations with your magic research.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a proprietary database mapping out the VR companies and organizations and research institutions across the world. I believe it's just over 2,000 unique handles right now. And so we segmented it out 400 European companies. So that was our dedicated European sample. And we found that, you know, many of them were kind of popular and that people knew about, like Eon Reality, Unity, which I now is based in the US, and then Sias VR, I believe is what they're called. They're also based in the US. And so some of those companies, like, we knew about, but then there seems to be kind of common across the entire VR industry, several companies that seem to be just a web page and a phone number, an email, and maybe a tech demo. And surprisingly, some of them didn't even have a tech demo. And so I went through something that, like, was definitely not, indicates our research, but I, like, for preliminary forecasts, just wanted to go through and see what I thought each company was worth. And I found that pretty much 70% of the companies in that sample were valued under $1 million. And that means that there's just nothing going on right now. It's either self-funded, it's a hobby project, or it's something that's going to take some time to become consumer ready, or if that's the case. And so we kind of got really kind of concerned about that also, because a lot of the data was publicly undisclosed and there was just not much going on. And so we got kind of, like, you know, a little sidestepped by that. We were just, like, surprised because there's hundreds I believe maybe there's 80, 90 startups accelerators across Europe. Maybe there's more, but I think that was the last number we talked about. And that was really surprising to me, because then there's also a lot of talent and research going on in academic institutions across Europe. And there's several grants and funding from the EU and European Commission for VR specifically. And it was just kind of strange. But then we started hearing more and more about, like, almost poaching from the US, where, you know, huge investors like I can never pronounce his name, but Andrewine Moritz or something like that, based in the New York, just, like, gave $20 million to a UK startup for some undisclosed product that they were working on. And that surmounted to 2/3 of the entire European Commission's VR research budget. And that was just really surprising to us. And so it kind of, like, indicated how the US right now is in this, like, hyper investment state. And so although there is due diligence happening with these investors, they're not just blindly throwing money at companies. It seems to indicate that the same is not true for Europe. As of right now, there seems to be a lot of hesitation to kind of invest in more than $1 million or $2 million, kind of, like, to bring a company, you know, not just on its heels, but, like, you know, pushing it out into the world. It seems there to be some hesitation there, and that was what was really surprising to us.
Yeah. So maybe Nima can describe first now his own experience, how hard it is to gather investment in Europe, because I think it maps very well on what you actually just described from your research.
Yeah, sure. I'd be glad to. As, like, intro, I should say that what we aim for in our company is very ambitious. It's to have full autonomy for drones, whereas most of the European companies that you see now generating revenue, they're either making drone frames, drone hardware, or majority of them doing drone service. So this was something unheard of. Still, we could attract an angel investor, so we got a good six-digit angel financing to start. But then as we went forward, we felt there's, like, a real vacuum for high-tech hardware plus software investors in Europe that we could even talk to. As an example, in Berlin, which is known as kind of the next startup hub in Europe, there's only one guy who says invest in robotics and drones, and he has not made any investments yet. And the one VC company who is credible, they have decided to invest in another manual service company. That means they don't actually have any technology, but they just do drone services. They fly drones. We went forward thinking that, okay, so there's not an investment committee here. We could just get funding from industrial partners. But then again, everybody was still busy to get over the hype and understand the market. I think it's quite the same with VR and augmented reality that you hear a lot in the media, some, you know, unicorns being formed, but still in the business world, it's the value proposition is not clear yet. So I think the challenge for any high-tech startup in Europe is that how do you form your ambition in a way that is more seen in Silicon Valley and but at the same time start up from inside Europe, one of the hubs in Europe where investors usually expect from you to have already some kind of traction, customer, or a very clear trajectory how to generate revenue quite early. So I think the difference that we felt from talking to European investors and a couple of US investors was, first of all, in US, they don't have time to waste. They don't just go around window shopping for startups. They make it really quick. It took us like a half an hour plus another half an hour to get commitment from a US investor. It takes multiple weeks, gets to months. You become friend with the guy and you don't see any cash in Europe. So I think that was the general observation that we had in Europe. And I think Sean also touched upon this topic that in Europe, you see a lot of public funding going into all kinds of academic projects, but quite rarely you see successful startup spin-offs coming out of that. Switzerland is a little bit of an exception here for drones, but the rest, you put a lot of money in multiple European projects instead of pumping that euro into one high-growth startup and then pushing it to become the next Google, the next Facebook, the next Oculus.
Well, there is actually one project that Salt and Pepper I'm working on. I think this and rather EU-founded investment with involvement of research institutes makes a little bit more sense because it's touching upon pain management. And when you're thinking about using virtual reality, you know, for pain management, you kind of have a lot of restrictions and regulations around medical usages. So something that is, you know, so slow to develop as, you know, something for medical purposes, there I think it might actually make sense to have, you know, rather a slower approach, and you have many collaborators, and the idea is not to have a product but something that might be a product, because first need to research is it usable or not. But I mean, it's pretty clear if you want to have the next, you know, entertainment or any kind of serious application, you need to do it quick, because otherwise other companies will just do it, right? So you can't just, you know, search half a year for investment. You need to work on your project in this half a year, and if you don't, you kind of are lost, right?
And one interesting kind of general point that I think applies to the VR market too is that in the drone space, because in Europe you don't get a high amount of initial investment, people start generating tiny amounts of revenue just to stay alive. And that means they do services. This converts to, I believe, creating content for VR instead of creating the platforms for VR. So now almost all the standard drone platforms are either coming from US or China. There are only very niche B2B kinds of applications have some kind of well-known European drone manufacturer. I'm very interested to know if this applies also to the VR market, that you see more content provider, people who just make their own 360 rig, or they use Unity and they just make, you know, some kind of application or content for VR instead of creating the hardware and the platform.
Yeah, actually, definitely have been seeing that as well. And it's actually been advisable in this market, because I don't know if you guys heard about the new LG HMD that just got announced. I think like a day afterwards, Gizmodo, a pretty large tech site, pretty much trashed it, saying that it was one of the worst HMDs they've ever done. And that's exactly been something that I've been fearing for. I didn't think a huge company like that would have done an HMD or announced something like that a little bit, I would say, late in the game as it is now. But yeah, that's been kind of the fear, since the hardware market is very fickle, and there's several leading players with years of research going into it. And so it's definitely smarter in the VR space to go into content, as it's kind of like the chicken or the egg problem. If you have great hardware, it doesn't really mean anything. You can't do anything with it. And so we need more content. We need more experimentation with the content. We need people kind of like branching out, trying new things. And if it fails, trying something else and keeping that, you know, that process going, so that in a couple of years we have, you know, the next Angry Birds, I guess, is one type of example you can see where everyone's like, oh, have you played that game? Have you played this game? You know, but for VR. And so, and then hopefully from there, we can get some branching out into non-gaming industries or non-gaming verticals with the same process. Definitely. But you brought up a good point, Nima, where also to kind of like contradict myself a little bit, is that the hardware market is fickle. And so production companies, content companies are creating their own internal in-house hardware to make the content they want to make. So there's several 3D capturing tools out there. Like for real estate, there's Matterport. And then like for Jaunt, Lytro's got a light field camera coming out, Google Tango. But I've talked to several production companies, and most notably recently at CES, that develop their own hardware. They have their own engineers just kind of strapping great cameras together. And then they do the painstaking process of hand stitching it, which I just, you know, God bless them. and that's because either they don't want to pay to get that kind of like third party hardware that to them isn't doing what they want, or that they have a specific vision that they need to kind of fulfill in their own way. And right now that's doing their own internal work. And I see that changing, but that was really telling right now, because even the high end gear that's out there just might not be suitable for everyone's taste because it's such a young market. And so it's really interesting like that, and seeing where it goes.
Well, I mean, in terms of Europe, you kind of really see only a few companies out there that do really produce hardware. And with produce, I mean, you know, they have the successful Kickstarter and are actually showing something. I mean, there are a little bit more companies there that show some HMD prototypes, but other than CyberRiff, that I actually tried myself, I don't know of any gear that comes from Europe that you can actually, you know, touch on exhibition or anything.
It's really impressive. There's Bubble, if it counts as VR hardware, Bubble Cam, the 360 camera. I think they're
okay. Brands. In terms of cameras, sure. I mean, Nokia also makes a 360-degree camera, right? But I mean, whether Nokia is right now pure European or not is debatable. But I mean, it's also a problem if you start to create hardware in Europe. I mean, What do you tell your investor? What is it used for, right? I mean, there is an Oculus, and there is a Vive, and there is, you know, Sony Morpheus. So why would you even, you know, care right now to create anything other than content? I mean, the market is kind of filled. What LG did, I kind of also, when I first saw the news about, you know, their HMD, I wondered myself, what would it be used for, right? I mean, they don't have any games like the Gear VR. Well, the only thing it can actually be used for is watching films, which is nice. But then the thing is, you know, not really an HMD in the sense that we understand it under the Gear VR, but rather, you know, some goggles to watch some content.
Does it have head tracking, this LG HMD?
No.
I think it does, but it wasn't clear.
Well, yeah, exactly. I don't think it was clear.
Well, that's a stark detail to kind of leave out.
I kind of feel LG just wanted to have their own version of Samsung Galaxy.
Yeah, it looks like that.
And I mean, that's one thing that like I definitely want to stress in this industry is that we don't, like at this point, we don't want people doing stuff like that, like releasing an HMD just because the market's hot right now. Yeah. I've heard several big players talk about this in advertising as well. We don't want to be just doing 360 ads because it's all the rage right now. Mm-hmm. In a sense, it's good because it will weed out those who aren't going to continue doing it. But it can also, I just think back to the 90s when everyone was hot for VR just as is now. And then a couple media, you know, films came out. And then like, you know, the Virtual Boy came out and the high price of these HMDs just got, you know, people turned off. And then people were like, eh, whatever. And then the Nintendo 64 came about, the internet came about, and everyone forgot about it. And so I just really want to stress that we shouldn't just be releasing products that are labeled VR just because it's cool. I understand it from a market standpoint. It's just like a quick way to make a buck, but it's not good for the industry. And so that's why I stress that we shouldn't be releasing more hardware in a market that, once again, let's just reiterate, Samsung Gear VR is the only hardware that's like out right now. That's like people really know about. Oculus is still a month out. Same with Vive, about a month and a half. And then PSVR is going to be sometime this year. And so creating a hardware right now and then trying to go through the marketing campaign, I mean, the market doesn't exist yet. There's pre-orders out, there's people there's interest out, but there's no market yet. So like to just kind of release and a brand new HMD into a market that doesn't really exist yet is just asking for that. A Gizmodo article is really what I was thinking, just asking for that is just for people to trash it, because as you guys probably know, consumers can be very, very picky and very, like, very harsh and can turn over
definitely
an entire industry overnight just from dissatisfaction. So,
You see, I was actually a few weeks ago on an event from the biggest manufacturer of a product worldwide. So, I cannot disclose which company it was, but it's German based and they are huge and they invested a lot of money into digitalizing their company, how they call it. And my job there with my colleagues was, you know, to show in a certain way the possibility of virtual reality. And there were some guys showing, you know, possibilities of augmented reality. And they had all their managers there and they looked at it and they were all amazed. The question is, why would they do it? I mean, they spent a lot of money looking at this technology that most of those people who are rather into sales at least get in terms of, you know, you can boost your sales with it in terms of you can show people your products in 3D when you go out. But other than that, they are not making, you know, strategic decisions. And if you try to speak to anyone who is in charge of, you know, some Mittelstand, as you call it in Germany, so companies that are not big but not small, to any other, you know, SMUs, if you talk to them, you know, suggest them using VR, they kind of look at it, they're interested, but they don't see particularly a value out of it. And I think a big problem is this wow thing that is, you know, being used by everyone. Oh, now we have 360 degree and now we can do this and now we can do that. Okay, for entertainment, it's amazing. I mean, it's clear VR porn in 360, you know, will be a huge thing. I think we have to mark now our episode NSFV, but it's fine. But you see, anything beyond, you know, maybe some traveling videos. But if you want the industry, for example, and this is my kind of key feature, you know, to try to sell to virtual reality to industry. If you try to, you know, to present them it, you need to say, what is the gain, right? I mean, are the devices, you know, precise enough? Is it perfect? And there is also not particularly any good content out there. And they have in previously, 10 years ago, spent millions on caves, you know, with beamers, projectors, and some kind of data gloves, and it was awful. So they are very hesitating. And now you have all kind of, you know, small startups that get a little bit money and they don't produce anything particularly good. And this is, you know, looking like a bubble when it's pretty clear that virtual reality has a future, yet all those small companies that are, you know, not particularly producing anything valuable will just burst. Sure, but the big companies will stay, I think.
Yeah, and so I think like the bad taste that was left in everyone's mouths after the 90s might still be in Europe. You know, full disclosure, I'm not a European, so I could be totally wrong here, but I think what I've heard about with a lot of our advisors and people we know in the industry who survived the 90s are now back working in VR and they're grateful for it, is that they couldn't even use the term virtual reality. They had to say like 3D immersive environments. And like if you coined it a virtual reality, like if you coined that or you try to bring that up in a conversation, like you'd get so many eye rolls So I think that might be what's going on a little bit in Europe still right now, is that like that has, that taste has like stayed in people's mouths, but like the reality of the advancement of technology has yet to fully sink in. And that like we have, I think as John Carmack put it, like unlimited computational power right now. If you can build it, you can make it. Like, so we're at that stage right now, custom rigs to make the most immersive VR game or environment is possible. It just requires a lot of work. And so we're at that point. Like, and so that's why these HMDs are coming out. That's why this great software is coming out. And so it really just takes like some convincing. And I think that's why this podcast is so important, you know, for people in Europe who maybe think that VR is all about porn and games. Because even in the US, if I talk to someone who's not particularly, you know, knowledgeable about VR, porn is always brought up in the first 5 minutes. Like, it's all, and I always have to be like, okay, yeah, sure. Like, porn has spurred many technological advancements in some way, whether it was like, you know, the VHS, DVD,
absolutely,
Blu-ray, I mean, and 3D TV, I've even heard, sure, absolutely.
But broadband.
Yeah, no, actually. Yeah, they've done so many advancements in video streaming.
Just looking at where we are now, it's all powered by porn. But I mean, and that's the argument, but it's always coming from a place of ignorance, I have to say, because if you look at the real today applications of VR, like, you know, realty right now, real estate is so, you know, in a prime space to pivot into mainstream adoption of VR, because it's just just looking from like a broker's standpoint, a customer comes in, he's a little hesitant, you know, it's just like, I kind of want to look at a place on the west side, but, you know, I'm thinking about actually, you know, maybe moving out of state. So if you have some properties there, you can now showcase 12 unique properties over like 3 different states in the United States in like 5 minutes.
This is great. I mean, just jumping here. In Germany, you don't really get to get your own private tour of the property. You have to wait for a certain date, and then they bring 20 people, and then you have to just make your mind.
Yeah, well, it depends how much money you spend. But I mean, also in terms of Europe, if anyone who is from Europe listening to us, on the CeBIT 2016, this is like the biggest fair in the world about technology. I would actually show an app that I'm currently working on, Salt and Pepper, that is trying to implement a concept for displaying information in a useful way in three-dimensional space. And I also have some other apps that are targeting people in industry who are working with, you know, 3D files, like OBG format files, CID files, where if you design, let's say, a car or an engine, you could in 3D already see if you can maintain it easily or not, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have to print it out. You don't have to put it in on top of it. The engineers can do it already. There's also a great thing, not to plug too much myself, from Middle VR. This is this company from Italy, surprisingly. I think French or Italy, that have recently showed this great video where with their engine, so based on top of Unity, you can disassemble a windmill with a lot of people in a room, and you can have, you know, kind of engineers being in a virtual room discussing a model that they can disassemble and look at the details. So there is something coming, but it's on, I mean, it's not as present as porn,
fortunately. Yeah, so that's a really interesting point, and it makes me think of two things. So as of right now, and I think this is where like the basis of this whole conversation came from, is that it's advisable for a European VR startup with some great talent or great idea that they know like is great for the industry, but they just can't find the funding. It's actually advisable for them to relocate to the United States to find funding. So, you know, I mean, I know it's ridiculous, but like considering the trends in investment, it's like, you can, I mean, sometimes like the as you said with Apple acquiring Mateo, is that they'll just come in and like suddenly you'll have like a, you know, a huge investor from the US at your door in Europe, and they really want to talk to you, and you'll get an investment, and then the next step usually after that is like, all right,
it's coming here,
relocating to USF. So that's very common. But what I guess to build off of that point, so that's what's like advisable today. But ideally, in the next year or two, or maybe 5, depending on the acceleration of the market, is that the market exists globally. So we have HMDs, HTC, PSVR, Oculus, and maybe some other ones that are still in development coming out. And everyone's got one. Gear VR has got a pretty robust ecosystem already that will grow. And so that content developers can now actually support themselves by their own content. Now, what that looks like, whether it's going to be subscription, freemium, one-time purchase, we still have to wait and see. The one thing that I personally, as a gamer, have been really trying to talk to people about, because I don't hear anyone talking about, is AAA VR gaming. Is that going to be priced at $60 US, or I don't exactly know what that is for the euro, but similar pricing? Is that the goal? I know it is internally. That's what people want to reach, or if not charge more. But if people are only going to be playing your game 30 minutes at a time, you got to really take that into consideration for,
Sean,
mass sales. So
why do you think the 30 minutes is the time frame that you're thinking about playing games? Because, I mean, that was a big problem with mobile when it first started, mobile gaming. Then people realized bite-sized gaming is really the way to go, and it suits that system.
Yeah.
Do you think that shorter bursts of gaming will be the norm for VR?
Not necessarily. There's always going to be those VR enthusiasts who can go hours into the time. I once talked to a developer at Valve who says he spends 3 hours in the Vive every day. And it's like, and I try to tell him, but he's like, sometimes people are so involved in what they're doing that they can't see outside of it. And so what I'm trying to let people know, and this is why we do these consumer reports, to understand mainstream kind of awareness and then like preferences with VR. I really think it's going to be about 30 minutes to an hour average time. Maybe it's the state of technology as of right now, even though it's really good. People just don't necessarily want to have a headset on completely strapped into a world for that long. Obviously, VR enthusiasts like myself can go in for like an hour plus. But that's I'm not everyone. The developers don't represent the wide, audience that VR can attain. And so I think it will be bite-sized in the short term. Just look at the Gear VR right now. And then I think it will grow as like really great content comes out. So that's where it comes from. We need people to make that great content where you don't want to leave. Maybe that has some social implications of, addiction that I'm sure some people would love to bring up.
Definitely. But I have to play here the devil's advocate too. I mean, look, there is nothing out that the consumers could play right now. I mean, we basically don't know what will happen. I mean, okay, you have some nice demos like, I Expect You to Die or some other games that are great. It's amazing. But even on the Gear VR, those $10 games are great, but you won't play them for hours. I mean, those are just not the games that are out on the mass market and AAA level. So when they come out, I mean, let's imagine some World of Warcraft style games that, massive multiplayer with virtual reality. Some people might be actually, spending 24/7 there.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where the higher price comes, or the subscription comes. So I expect that eventually, definitely. I look forward to it. Are you kidding me? I used to play WoW as a kid. So I'm really looking forward to that. But I think right now, games like Eve Valkyrie, in particular, I love that game. I really, full disclosure, that game's really fun. I played several demos of it at several different shows at several different levels of the Oculus prototype. And I'm really looking forward to that. But I still think back and I'm like, can they charge $60 for a game like that right now? I wouldn't necessarily buy that, because I don't know if I'm necessarily getting everything that I would normally get a AAA game for that price.
Sean, I mean, you can always put some kind of heads in it so you can pay them for money or some, obscure skins. Yeah. There's always a way to give the game for free that people will spend $300 on crazy hats and crazy pants.
Yeah, exactly. That's where this kind of comes from, is like, where is this subscription model going? And I think Europe is going to have a very interesting place in this market as it goes on, because and this kind of brought up to what we were talking about several times now, the socio-political differences of these markets, the hyper investment in the US and maybe the lack of hyper investment in Europe. Once this market establishes itself, I think Europe is going to have a very interesting part to play in kind of the whole overall structure of content delivery, content creation, types of content, and revenue models. I'm really curious to see because, you know, if the US companies are just trying to charge $60 out the gate and microtransactions, on top of that, Europe might be able to see that and with their own, you know, unique environment, be able to do that, do the same type of quality content and maybe reduce the cost and drive the market. And I think overall that's going to drive the market to making better, cheaper content. So
that's for sure. Yes.
I look forward to that.
Maybe coming back to our original topic. I mean, the glass ceiling of European virtual reality startups. I mean, there is a great article that we actually got all inspired by, I think. Mm-hmm. It's from, if I don't understand me correctly, it's written by Christoph Fleischmann. Mm-hmm. It's very good for a link to it. But we also mentioned before, what should you do as someone who is, let's say, struggling to create a VR startup here in Europe? And to my understanding, what I actually observed myself is anything that is a rather software solution based. So you're creating software for a customer or you're creating a product that will work great. You can find people in Europe who can code amazingly well and, you know, understand Unity and can create things. And if you find one, two, three customers that are now wealthy and maybe in the industry, you can survive and have your own small startup in Europe for years, maybe for decades. So that's an option. I mean, it's not comparable to this astronomic, you know, enormous growth of Uber, Google style, but you still can, you know, have your own company and live off it. And in this article that is, there is a glass ceiling for European virtual reality startups, there is basically the claim that in the beginning, there is, you know, the first money is there in Europe and US for the startups. But later on, it's just not keep coming. So I think in the pre-talk, we had this discussion on those European accelerators that, you know, it's rather a prestige to have them. I think NEMA dropped out, by the way. But maybe Sean can remember what we discussed. Do you remember this thingy?
Yeah, the number of startups, or sorry, accelerators across Europe, there's definitely a large number. I think NEMA said there's about 87 specifically. I think I thought there was more than that. So that did surprise me and kind of rearranged my thinking on it. But it just really was telling to me there's this many accelerators out there. There is a sizable amount of money, although albeit undisclosed, out there funding these startups. But yet we're not seeing like the same type of like growth and like kind of company like unicorns coming out of Europe. Mm-hmm. We sadly aren't, because I personally that makes me sad, because I know there's a lot of talent out there because of all of these research grants and funding that's coming from the EU and
During the pre-talk that we had with Nima and Sean, we have been actually discussing what's written in this article. There is a glass ceiling for European virtual reality startups. We will link it in the show notes. And the core idea of the article, as far as I understand it, was that early stage money is available in Europe and in the US. And we have a lot of accelerators actually in the EU, so in the European Union. However, in the progress of the startup, the money is just not coming. And Nima's thesis, and maybe you can also explain it in a moment, was that this way of, you know, investing a little bit of money here and there is rather prestige. So those accelerators are rather a prestige thing instead of, you know, actually following the idea to have the next Google.
Yeah. So I'll try to be as objective as I can. Upfront disclosure, I did go to one of these accelerators in Berlin Hardware Accelerator, and we got accepted to a couple of others that we decided not to go. And in Germany, in specific, where I live, most of accelerators are run or funded or sponsored by corporates. And they are more of a PR channel for them to look like they're innovative and they have, you know, a startup arm or some kind of incubator than actually an independent VC fund who is also running an accelerator program for deal flow. It's not even that. And so what you see is they're just following US by running all kinds of incubators and accelerator programs. But most of them, first of all, they do not give you the same amount of funding that you get from top-notch accelerator programs in US. So it's like 5K, sometimes no money for no equity. Like, it's a good thing. And go there, you get a free desk for a couple of months, and the mentors, you know, I'm friend with some guys who run accelerator program. They're just, their names are there. But sometimes they do commit, but in general, they don't get shares of your company. It means they do not really have some kind of vested interest in your company. And at the end, you become like a pet project for these large companies. The sad thing is I heard the only accelerator program or incubator in Europe based in Berlin that was putting a lot of money, like 100K, 300K, actually closed down the office, and they're moving to Silicon Valley. Even European,
exactly.
large European corporations, the ones who are really serious about investing, apparently they decide to first start a fund in Silicon Valley and then open like a satellite office in Berlin or London.
Yeah, which is amazing. I mean, let be clear. So Sean mentioned before that, you know, if you're a startup and you really want to be successful and big, the chances that you will get funding in US are rather bigger. Now, I mean, obviously here is a podcast, we are trying, you know, to kind of address the issue and, you know, lurk every of the creative minds, you know, brain drain from Europe to US. But I mean, in a certain way, it looks like there's less and less chances to be successful here, right?
I mean, for sure, it's an upward trend. People are trying to be better. Everybody is trying to do good. Nobody is doing things, you know, by purpose, doing shitty things to poor startups. But the issue is Europe has this kind of pressure because US is doing all those great things and they have unicorns. We hear all of them. So Europe is much closer to US culturally and distance-wise than, let's say, Middle East or Asia. So you have this pressure to follow. And as a result, things get cloned without the right talent, the right depth and experience to run those programs and initiatives. So this could also brings us to maybe another conclusion that I have personally. Probably Europe is going to be the way it is, and it's fine. Like, nobody is killing themselves because Hollywood is in US, or nobody is crying in Frankfurt that New York Stock Exchange is whatever it is. So things are the way they are, and Europe has other good things. We have social equality, you know, people are having a safe life. But on the other hand, if you are an aspiring entrepreneur with a high growth startup, maybe you have a better start in another continent.
Well, in fact, during our pre-talk, we had also discussed it more deeply, so we won't go here, but the social inequality in the US compared to Europe, you know, is huge. So, I mean, in the US, it's very easy to get, you know, compared to Europe, very rich, you know, you have less taxes and you can have your huge startup, and in Europe it's rather slow. However, I mean, if you fail in Europe, you're not really, you know, doomed for the rest of your life. There are some social nets, you can get some support. And our thesis was, you know, in a certain way that in US, when you fail, you can fail, you know, there's no way back, you know, you have loans. And if you don't do a crazy, cool startup in 1 year, you can, you know, you're done. So just a different pressure.
Yeah, doesn't that make sense that there would be a lot more entrepreneurship happening in Europe because of these kind of safeguards and the safety nets that most people have? I mean, that's the question. It's like, why are we here? And isn't it more of a cultural cultural difference in the investing side in Europe than it is here? Because I think that we're just seeing two different intentions. Like, if you're saying all these accelerators in Europe are more of like a PR front or just to say kind of something they check off their, you know, list of things to do to be a cool new company, accelerators here are really trying to like create unicorns, trying to make something amazing with, you know, 10-15 year long plans down the line.
Okay, maybe it's important for the audience that's not maybe European based to explain one thing. Europe is more about, you know, sustainability and definitely more about this diversity. So, you know, sure, it has stopped that, you know, London and Berlin try to compete each other, you know, as a startup place, but they don't really talk as much as maybe, you know, New York and Silicon Valley or anything like that. So, I mean, you have rather distinct countries are somehow united, but it's not compared to, you know, the United States of America, where everyone speaks the same language. And then you have also rather different rules, different taxation, and all the other things that come to it. And also the core idea, I mean, 30%, maybe 20%, don't quote me on that, of the money that European Union spends is rather on agriculture, you know. They support that food is not very expensive and, you know, they finance, you know, the farmers, which is great, okay. I mean, the bread that I can buy in the supermarket is not very expensive. I have roads that I can drive on. And the infrastructure all in Europe is, I think, quite good. And if you look how companies, you know, behave, if you're one of those Mittelstands that we are, you know, mentioned before, you don't really have, in my understanding, at least when I saw, ambitions to grow crazy. I mean, you maybe want to score another client, but when I was on a virtual reality conference in Italy, where all some companies were there, they were saying, okay, we have 3-4 clients, they're big, we are doing here something with helicopter, some tutorial videos, it's great. And, you know, they have 300-400 employees and they're happy. They don't particularly want to expand. On the other hand, they also feel that something is, you know, maybe not very hip about the way how they, you know, do their business, because there are those gigantic investitions over in US, and okay, 1% of US living incredibly well, and also Silicon Valley is an incredibly well placed, but maybe because we are so slow and steady, like what Nima also said, in the EU, we are rather, you know, having slower, you know, slower ongoing with us. But all the crazy stuff being done in the US, and thanks to you, we are getting all the benefits out of it. And we don't have, you know, to make a lot of our population very poor. So a lot of our population very rich and, you know, can do this crazy investment stuff. I don't know, maybe it's that way.
And then you face the issue that even technologies and products that come to Europe and are being used, they're not made in Europe. They're not made here, and we just need to adopt them. This could go on for some time, but it will eventually threaten core, you know, heavy industries of Europe, like in the auto industry. If Apple and Google and Tesla get into cars, what could happen? I mean, BMW and Mercedes-Benz could become like the next Foxconn, like just a blind factory making the chassis for the next Apple car. So I think we talked a lot about what is wrong with Europe, but maybe we should also see what are the opportunities here. It's a very diverse continent. You have a lot of talent from the academia. So I think with a little bit of time, maybe 5 to 10 years, we're going to get to a place where you will not see a significant difference from like the perspective of where you are located. So many things are going to be democratized that if you are a startup in China, US, Iran, or, you know, wherever, Europe, it doesn't really matter. But at the moment now, I personally, I don't see that happening. I don't see that being true now.
That brings up a really interesting point too, because when we were doing our US consumer report for VR trends, we saw a lot of interest. And so that kind of propelled us to maybe expand our reach to the, you know, to Europe. And then we settled on the UK, since the UK in our own internal estimates has the second largest community to the US in regards to VR companies, I believe specifically, and then VR community as well is also really strong there. And then we saw a real drop off in interest for the UK sample than we did for the US. And so that's why we focused on US and UK comparisons. And so really with talking with some of our clients, we actually kind of found out that everyone thinks that the US is going to be the leading trendsetter and everyone else is going to follow. And that seems to be pervasive across the industry, which is why European companies are, you know, relocating to the US because they want to set the trend. And I found that, I find that to be true to a certain degree. But obviously each country is, and each culture is going to do something different with this medium. So I think as the market stabilizes and garners like a global presence, we'll see like the unique aspects of each culture and the talent that resides within it kind of come about in a unique way. So maybe it'll take 5 to 10 years, as Nima's saying. I hope not. But maybe it will. I guess that's really where it stands right now. A lot of companies, big companies, think that the U.S. is going to be the dominant trendsetter, and by the numbers, that's true right now. I guess by the consumer base and funding and company and presence in Silicon Valley and all these other things. But you know that really does put everyone else in the shadows. That I don't think should be. Like, there are some really unique companies doing some unique things across Europe and Russia and in Asia. And so I'm really kind of hoping that equalizes out and we get some more presence, on a global level. So we'll see. But I think that's just where it stands right now.
Well, I mean, you mentioned the Tesla example. The reason why... the company Tesla was able to build so quickly actually their own car is very simple, because in an electric car you have 100 times less parts than in a gasoline filled car, because the engine is just way more complex in a car that drives, you know, by explosions, small tiny explosions inside, than with cars and, you know, just have one engine, one battery and just goes. So the complexity of the car just got, at least from the, you know, construction part, reduced. And if you see, I mean, Tesla is not producing their own brakes. Tesla is not particularly producing maybe even their motors. They're buying them most likely from Bosch or whoever. So there are still those companies that are suppliers. And even VW, I mean, what are they doing? They're just buying from 1,000 of companies, small parts, and they're doing the integration job. So I mean, this is a complexity for a car that actually, you know, runs all those small, tiny explosions inside a motor. But with this, I mean, okay, Internet of Things and big data and stuff are buzzwords, right? But let's be honest, in a certain way, the way how, you know, the digitalization drives right now the progress of things, like electrical cars, like maybe virtual reality, like anything, you know, like smartphones. You can put more sensors, stuff gets maybe cheaper, you know, mass scale. And in the way that the US market is unique, I mean, Europe cannot compete with it, because you have 250 million people that speak the same language and it's one market. We just don't have it. And that's why you can have a Google, and why the European Union all the time tries, you know, to have laws against Google, because, you know, maybe jealous, I don't know, maybe they're really afraid of it. And there are some things in terms of privacy. I mean, I'm a big privacy advertiser, you know, and privacy is important, but you can't just, if you don't have your own Google, try all the time to say, oh, Google is evil. Okay, make something better. And it's just not going to happen because we don't have the market. Like, I mean, Russia has its own Google, this Yandex search engine, but they have a big enough market for that. Germany has not a market for having its own search engine. And why would you do it right now? It doesn't pay off anymore because the search engine market is established. And it might be that virtual reality, something similar will happen. I mean, we have IBM, we have Intel that do chips, and we will have maybe Oculus and Vive that do, you know, headsets. And that's how it is. It will be established. Maybe it will change when, you know, smartphones came and ARM processors suddenly disrupted everything. I don't know.
I think this is going to change in the next five years. I mean, I'd say even up to 10 years, the trendsetters will come about. And I'm not saying that Oculus and HTC are the only two trendsetters that will be, right? And by trendsetters, I mean like the major guys. And no, yeah, you're absolutely right. They're not here. And so the potential for even European startups to be that trendsetter is still there. Maybe the funding isn't as easy to get, or maybe you should get funded from an accelerator in America, but you can still have your offices there for whatever reason. But the potential is still really huge. And I think the best place to kind of concentrate on is doing the software solutions and the software side of things, because you don't want to make an HMD. The HMDs are, you need a decade of research to even get something going right. So, let's
there was actually recently a great quote, and I'm sorry, I'm kind of quoting your competitors. As Gartner said on a on conference. I mean, they are very conservative with their predictions. I don't particularly like them, but the quote was great. They said, just stop doing HMDs. There is enough out there. Stop doing the next cardboards. You know, just stop. And I totally agree with it. Every day I open the news, the next, you know, cardboard is out. And I'm thinking, okay, just spend your talent on something.
I don't understand that
else.
Market.
I don't get it. But where do they sell
them? I don't
them?
Understand it either. Unless you are doing something like Omido Mini, which
okay,
is like a very small
yeah,
thing
yes.
to put on. Yeah, unless you're doing that. And like, I don't want to wear a strap around my head for Google Cardboard because that's not even how it's used. No, like,
but,
that's
but
not completely wrong.
Guys, I have some insights from the drone market that also I feel the same thing is happening to the VR market. About 1 or 2 years ago, if you looked at the market, you would say, oh, we have DJI, we have Parrot, there's no more space for anybody to make any drone. But almost every month, you see a new successful Kickstarter campaign or a new startup getting multiple millions of funding for another cool drone frame that has follow me abilities.
Yeah, but it
I
makes
don't know
sense.
If that's the same though.
Yeah, it makes sense.
I don't know if we can compare the same hardware.
Yeah,
though.
It's just
I
mean, a cardboard. It's just a piece of plastic you strap your phone inside, and then you have okay. And I mean, I love the Google Card experience, Google Cardboard experience, because you can give it out. It's very, you know, nice. But you don't want to spend hours inside it. It's nothing you really
I mean,
will use other than for marketing.
That was kind
you
know? Of Google's initial kind of like fears with that. That was originally just an experiment that they like. Didn't understand that would be so popular. And so now I think what they realized, and which is why they're pushing a little bit harder and announcing that they've released 5 million or shipped 5 million of them, is that it's so accessible. It is, and that's the key thing. It doesn't mean that it's the best VR experience. No one is saying that. It's what it's saying is that it is a potential VR experience, and it can give someone an idea of what it's like. And it's so easy. I mean, Taylor, give me your phone. All right, download an app. It's already good. Okay, here you go. Strapped in it. Boom. There you go. Have fun. Like,
sure. Speaking from kind of stuff that I develop, in a certain way, if you're now a salesman, you go from person to person, you kind of want to show them a kitchen or a stove or anything. You kind of can show them, even with Vuforia, the stove augmented in the room with Google Cardboard. You know, you just put a hole there, the camera can view it. Or you can just show them in a way, you know, some kind of environment you want to sell them, or a building or a car, whatever. I mean, it's very easy to show 3D objects or anything else with this technology. You know, you still cannot beam it out, you know, we're not in Star Trek, but at least you can put the small piece of plastic and or paper on their head, and they suddenly are immersed and they can look around, and it kind of works. I mean, you see all those children, you know, use Google Cardboard, I mean, okay, Google posts,
yeah, I mean,
posts, but they look very happy.
I mean, I can see where you're coming from.
It makes a lot of fun.
They're not getting a true immersive experience. They might think that the state of technology is at the Google Cardboard level. But I think the consumers are a little smarter than that. And I think if someone who's never tried VR before, and let's say it's like a 13-year-old who doesn't have any idea what happened with VR in the first wave in the late 80s and 90s, I think they'll see that, and the potential and the dreaming aspect of it that will like kind of enter their eyes will be so immense that it'll cause them to look more. And I think just as time goes on, honestly, our expectations are going to just continue to be shattered. That's the one thing that I've personally in the last couple months have really begun to realize, is that all of our expectations, like for the next 5 years, are going to shatter. Like, one of the earliest forecasts for 2020 was that the industry is going to be worth about $30 billion. I think that's already going to be shattered by 2018, 2019 maybe. And things like that are going to shatter, but also, like, technological advancements. I thought mobile positional tracking was maybe at least another year out, at least. And now we have two companies vying for mobile positional tracking for the Gear VR. Totally blanking on it. I'm totally blanking on them. They would probably
For Gear. Face Space. I saw that something they were doing at SFVR with. It was a Gear VR. Essentially, they were using a lot of light boxes around, and you actually supported up to four players, so four Gear VR headsets in one area.
I would actually.
There's a couple of them.
I would actually use the opportunity to plug a short video that you can maybe quickly look at, but we will also plug it in the show notes. It's from Toby Breeden, I hope I pronounce him well. He was actually listening to one of our previous episodes and sent me this amazing thing that he, you know, did himself. This is in a certain way some self-made platform. He calls hands-free FPS movement controller Walkbox. And in a certain way, you kind of put your feet inside it and you kind of slide them. And he claims on Reddit that this reduces his motion sickness incredibly. And this is something that I find, I find it amazing that someone is sitting privately, apparently, in their home, building some kind of VR input device. Maybe this will not hit the mass market, maybe. Oh, I don't know. But the idea that, you know, it fascinates people so much that they, like with their Arduino or any other things, you know, just start to hack around and create their own hardware. You know, it's very amazing.
You know what? This I'm looking at the video right now, and I had this epiphany the other day. Maybe not that amazing, but I was on one of those hoverboards, you know, the Chinese little hoverboards.
Yes.
And listen. So the locomotion and just moving with that feels of like a really natural and intuitive motion.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I want this in VR. So, I mean, I was like, this can really help solve the locomotion problem.
Yeah.
And I really, what this guy is doing with this walk box is essentially splitting up those two things that you put your feet on. And then you kind of, if you shift your feet forward, like the heels back and the toes forward, then you're going forward. Or if you know, that's kind of the same way you move around on a hoverboard as well. This is really cool, actually.
Yeah, it's surprising. And I mean,
I don't know how it's so relevant for our discussion right now.
I just promised him to plug it. And we constantly okay. forgot
Weird
it
spot
since
to plug
two
it
episodes.
In the middle
and
of the conversation.
I thought that before we go too deep into any other peripherals.
Right.
But I just want to support Sean's idea that, you know, there is more surprising stuff coming out, right?
Further and quicker than you could predict. Yeah, this kind of goes into what I think I read in the Goldman Sachs report with like an accelerated uptake, like base case. And so what could happen is that if VR really does pick up, more money, more talent is going to be flowing into it. And so we'll see things that we thought and we predicted were going to be a couple years out, but they're now happening. So like the one company I was mentioning is called Universes that are doing positional tracking, which a couple publications like Road to VR, VR Focus, Upload have been tracking them. But they were still at a really jittery, not really good state, but they just recently released a really good looking positional tracking video for the Gear VR, and I believe it just requires a camera, and it's an external camera, so nothing attached to the headset that you
need.
And that's pretty freaking amazing. So you combine that with Samsung Gear VR's hand controllers that they're releasing, the haptic controllers of Rink, thank you, Rink. And once those kind of come out, then you have something that will easily compete with Oculus and HTC Vive, just because, like, no matter how great those experiences are, I mean, I'm a gamer, but I'm also a console gamer primarily, mainly because PC gaming just requires so much extra work that at the end of a long day, when I used to play Skyrim and mod the crap out of that, at the end of the day, I hated that I had to mess with so many resolutions and kind of like update my, you know, either update my drivers or reload my computer because I had just like, and I mean, I become a perfectionist. So like if I'm normally at 30, 40 frames per second, but for some reason it's dropping to 20, I'll spend 20 minutes just figuring out why that happened. And so I believe that's the case with all consumers. And so...
Well, I mean, personally, I would argue PC is still better, but I understand you understand a lot of consumers.
Mr. PC Pastor race.
Yeah,
but
okay,
I think
okay, sure. Okay, but let's be honest.
It'll back to...
Yeah?
Listen, it'll come...
Yeah.
Sorry, guys. The whole mobile versus wired HMD is going to be the same thing with PC versus consoles. And cause since it's going to be an app on the phone, you will not have to tinker with anything. They just put it on and it'll work.
But maybe coming back to your saying this Goldman Sachs report and quoting it, I was actually, maybe I should shame myself, ranting a little bit about it on one of our episodes. What do you think about it? having a small rant about it in one of our first episodes, and maybe I was a bad one, but tell us that it's rather a good one.
Necessarily, the only thing that I will say is that I thought I was refreshing that they did a base case accelerated and delayed uptake of the market. I thought that was at this current point in time with the reports that we've seen and the absolute just like flamboyant projections that I've been seeing was very, very humbling, I thought. I thought there were other issues in the report, but I didn't. I mean, every report can have issues, so I'm not going to speak too much to that. But the idea that there's like a base case that you think is going to happen, a delayed one in case, you know, whatever reason, market doesn't, you know, doesn't qualify or doesn't build the speed that we're expecting, but yet it still exists, and then accelerated, I thought was a great way to look at how a developing industry is progressing. And so, as of right now, that's, I think, one of the more accurate ways to look at this market, because there's no surefire 100% accurate projection. I mean, in an undeveloped industry like VR, any projections that you make without like actual insider knowledge, it usually has a margin of error between 20 and 50%. So that's really huge. That's really huge. And so that's why I don't really look at projections. That's why at Greenlight, we've been waiting to make some pretty big projections, and now we're at a more comfortable place to be doing it. And so, yeah, I mean, besides that, you know, anyone who's not in the industry who's looking at VR will be making some mistakes. They'll not see the context. They won't see in between the lines. But the great thing about reports like this is that they're focusing on a lot of non-gaming applications, which is really what the industry needs to start doing as well. We really need to kind of, I guess that's where Oculus is coming in, and they're trying to focus on building that gaming marketplace so that from there it grows. But I already see the growth happening on other verticals, and I think we really need to see and educate other consumers and other, you know, other companies that aren't in the VR space that VR will eventually have a use case for them. It'll eventually have a benefit for their company, whether it's like real estate, medicine, yes. Architecture, I guess that's similar to real estate, but CAD design, 3D modeling, it just will happen. And as definitely technology grows and the prices go down, it will just be like, you know, it'll be like a joke to still be using a 2D screen to model your engine or something like that. It'll just be like, well, why don't you just strap on this headset and see every little inch? Ford's already doing that. Ford apparently doesn't even allow any physical prototype to come about unless it's been virtually approved. So that's really where I see it going.
Amazing.
Guys, I was just jumping in here. I was listening to the A16Z podcast today on the topic of VR is recently released. And they came to this point that what's left, what hard science problem is left, or what engineering problem is left. They, as investors, they said, not much. Apparently, it's just the presence feeling, and you just need to engineer.
That's bullshit.
I don't think maybe we have time here to talk about it. It was Chris Dixon, by the way. BS on him. Okay, so...
Well, I will very easily show him with one video that I will later put in the show notes from one of the core researchers from Oculus Rift, who I think gave a speech either on the Connect or
it was Oculus Connect.
You know, you remember his name, Azad?
Yeah, Michael. He's the CTO, I believe.
He's great
research lead. And
he explained in a understandable but scientific way that we are way before actually a real virtual reality thing, you know.
Michael Abrash.
Yeah,
that's what
I will plug this video, and there are so many things need to be solved. I mean, look, eye tracking in terms of, you know, full VR rendering is a small thing. The next thing that comes with it, you know, you kind of want to have a huge resolution that we cannot render it. Then you kind of want to interact. You want to have low latency, many people there. And those are just those things I remember from my mind. Then it's also all kind of interaction, touch, you know, all kind of things. And even, you know, such things as screen. I mean, the normal screen used right now in virtual reality HMDs is not suited for that because your eyes can refocus.
Yeah, I agree.
We're just at the beginning.
So much things.
You know, I said this not...
Yes.
So that's good news for European startups. They have a lot to do, especially with the deep scientific background that many research institutes have. So there's a lot left out there. In fact, maybe if we have the time in the next week, we could compile a list of undone things in the show notes for European startups to do. some investors have like...
I guess I just have to watch the video from the science guy. It will explain it very well. He is so good in it. But we can also compose a list, sure.
And another thing that I feel we didn't talk enough about was, okay, in Europe, we do not have maybe the best serious accelerator programs. But there's one example from US, Rothenberg Ventures. They have this river accelerator that I was surprised by how quick these guys became the leading player or the leading investor in the VR space. And there is no such investor yet for robotics. There are 2-3 funds who are focused solely on robotics, but none of them have the kind of success and the speed and momentum that these guys gained. And for the audience, they have an upcoming deadline for their next accelerator batch. So just if you have a startup, just go and apply. It's not just VR, I think it's also for AI startups.
Yeah, in fact, I actually once talked, VTimes, this app that you use to social VR.
Social VR.
Yeah, I guess it was the CEO of the company or someone who was in charge, of Clemens Wangerin, I think it's called. I actually had a Skype with him when we were doing research on why companies actually stay in Europe. And I remember he's based, I think, in Liverpool, so in England. And their idea was, we have all the people here, we don't need to move to US, because London, for example, is very well connected with the US market. So in a certain way, you see more startups in London and around London and in England per se than anywhere else. So I guess the location is also very important. Yet if you look who is listening to our podcast, we have some mysterious 10 to 15% from Estonia. So apparently, in Estonia, there's a lot of people who are interested in virtual reality, so maybe it's also a great country.
Yeah, I mean, Skype came out of Estonia. Why not the next VR giant?
Wait, Skype came out of Estonia? I did not know that. Really?
Yes. Yeah. And the co-founder of Skype is now the leading private investor in drones. The guy has, I think it's Toivo Annas. He has invested in virtually all the drone startups, like almost all of them.
Amazing. By the way, Yunima is someone who was running around Europe and looking at how people invest and how to get investment. So I think you once told me that investors in Europe search for companies who have customers already and not startups who develop tech. It's also something that happened to you. You want to develop in a certain way, a crazy drone that is flying autonomous, and it's harder to get investment for that compared to if you just have a lot of pilots who fly them. So would you say that if you want to kind of push startup in Europe, you should maybe have one or two customers, even if it's not particularly fitting too much your core idea, to just get all funding, or as a bad track?
It's not just in Europe that you need to have traction. Everywhere in US, it's good to have customers first. But it's also about understanding the difference of natures of different types of startups. Some of them can get to traction very quickly, and some of them need a lot of development before getting to that point. So for instance, as an extreme example, something like Magic Leap cannot be even imagined in Europe now to get like $500 million. Now it's even more without any product out in the market. So in Europe, I think it's still the common understanding that you need to have first a couple of customers to go to the Series A. But as we read in many reports, for the first angel and seed financing, it's almost like US. But when you want to propel yourself to the next level, then comes the bottleneck. So it might be a better idea, as everybody here suggested, to get to some prototype stage. If you can, relocate to US, go to some accelerator program, and then get enough funding to sustain yourself until you're out in the market. That's the norm here. But it kind of contradicts with the hyper growth that you expect from Silicon Valley type of startups. If you are looking for customers, you need to maintain those customers. You need to allocate your resources to sales and marketing and, you know, hiring people who actually do the work instead of paying for engineers and scientists to develop the product. So it doesn't really work well if you have something that needs a lot of development before being profitable.
Sure. I guess at that point we can make a soft cut and maybe last words from every one of our guests before we kind of go over to the last section where we speak about the listeners we have. So maybe what are the topics that you kind of would take with you?
It's a young market. Discussion? It's a very young market. Very remarkable. So although there's, young upwards market. To a couple billion in the US and not even close to that in Europe, that is going to continue to grow on every front. I once made a very lofty prediction, but I think it's still pretty true. Every vertical that's associated with gaming and VR has something in development, I continue to see growing. It's an upward trend, as I think Nima said, for Europe, but same for the US, and it will, if the US is the trendsetter, then Europe will continue to grow. And then I think at a certain point, Europe is going to start making its own trends and the US will begin to follow in some ways. So I hope to see that soon. Hope sooner rather than later. It's very young. So let's constantly align our expectations and know that, full immersive VR where like you're the Matrix, you're plugged in on a neural level is decades, if not never going to exist for political reasons or whatever, health reasons or however, however it is, maybe 50 years out. But right now we can do amazing things just with a smartphone. And if you want to go even farther with a great PC and a great rig, you can have the most immersive gaming or otherwise experience that has ever existed. So it's always good to have that historical perspective as we move forward, because it's only up from here.
Okay. Then thank you very much for joining us, Sean and Nima.
Yep.
It was a pleasure. It was a very great discussion, I think. And if our audience decides that they like it, they might write us an email at researchvrcast@gmail.com. We also have a website that is researchvr.podigy.io, so it will be as true, marked in the show notes, where you can subscribe to our podcast, listen to the previous podcast, have a full description and show notes, as well as the players that support chapmarks. So I'm not sure if all of listeners are aware, but we, in every episode so far, had chapter marks. That means that you can, from the audio file, actually see the topics and click through them if your podcast player supports it. Also, we have different feeds. And on Twitter, you can follow us at ResearchVRCast, which will also plug in the show notes.
How can everybody find you guys?
My Twitter is JohnGLVR, at JohnGLVR. Also, one more time, we are holding the 2016 Virtual Reality Analytics Web Summit. Research VR is going to be in attendance. It's going to be handled through WebEx, and all Research VR listeners can get 30% off the ticket price with the code ResearchVR on the Eventbrite main page on our landing page, which will be in the show notes.
I'm at Inside Nima. So inside, like outside, Inside Nima. and Nima.io. And I really look forward to living in a day when your VR headset should be FDA approved with direct brain interface. As a cognitive scientist,
that's what
I'm waiting for, when FDA is going to kick in and say, no, you cannot sell this, you need to get approved first.
Great thing about that is that it's got to be the FDA and the FCC and probably other couple of government organizations, since it has so much involved. We'll see.
Well, so for a bright future, thank you very much for tuning in. Thank you once again.
How about we make a thing now, Sean? Will on this day in a year from now, we'll do a podcast again just to do a little reevaluation of what we talked about today what has happened in just 365 days.
But
how about that?
But we will have better internet and maybe we will be all in the same place and not in four locations across the whole globe. Oh yes,
that's the plan.
All right,
everyone.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye bye.